From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made earlier this month when Republicans in Washington announced their opposition to a new child care and family plan. Florida Senator Marco Rubio calls it welfare and an expanded form of welfare assistance. His colleagues lampoon the plan as big government handouts, anti-work. So what was this plan? It's called the Family Security Act, a rather ambitious idea that would create a universal child allowance. And here's how the Washington Post breaks it down. Quote, for all parents, excluding the wealthiest families, the government would send $250 a month per child for youngsters aged 6 to 17, up to 5 children, and $350 a month for newborns to 5-year-olds. The plan would replace several other benefits and tax breaks, including the child tax credit, part of the earned income tax credit, temporary assistance for needy families, and the state and local tax deduction, and so would not increase the federal deficit. In other words, it's budget neutral. The allowance would cut child poverty by a third, according to the center-right organization, the Niskanen Center. End quote. So who put forward this plan that has some progressives cheering and so many Republicans lining up against it? It was Utah Senator Mitt Romney, a Republican. New York Magazine declared, quote, Mitt Romney's plan to help families and children is better than Biden's, end quote. Vox concluded that the Romney plan would make a real dent in poverty, and particularly in extreme child poverty. But some analysts do prefer President Biden's plan, which has some similarities to the Romney plan. The difference for now appears to be that Biden's plan is a one-year measure, while Romney's could be permanent. Our goal is to ignore which political party produces certain proposals and explore how they would impact real people, particularly families with young children. And our guest this hour will do that. Pete Nabosny is the Director of Policy for the Children's Agenda. Pete, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also welcome to Deandra Dukes, a small business owner, community advocate, and a cohort member of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Deandra, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And Jessica Fleming is a single mother of two back with us. Nice to have you back. Jessica, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Pete, let me start with you here. I think I heard from you before just about anybody a few weeks back. You wanted to flag and say, hey, this actually looks really interesting and does not matter where the parties are here. I mean, I know the Children's Agenda has been nonpartisan, but too often I think the media frames this as just a right or left thing. We're going to go into some of the details, but what was your first reaction to seeing the Romney plan, Pete?
Well, I'd first start by saying it was really refreshing to see a I don't agree with every component of the plan, just like I don't agree with every component of President Biden's plan, but to see a really comprehensive, thorough, and thoughtful approach to reducing child poverty is something that I think every political party, people who don't belong to any political party, people who are just concerned about the fate of children in our country should pay attention to. And so the fact that there was a serious, well-developed proposal that Senator Romney put out, hopefully will start to change the conversation about child poverty in our country, what we can do about child poverty, and really focus around what's the best way to help people as opposed to how do you score particular political points or base some of your positions on just opposition to the other side. It's really great to see a comprehensive plan to address this really critical challenge we have in our country of child poverty.
I think, Pete, I think Marco Rubio knew you were coming on the program today, and he wanted to get out ahead of you praising anything that Mitt Romney was doing. So he tweeted just a few hours ago, quote, sending $250 or $350 per month per child to everyone with no work requirement is welfare. Being pro-family means being pro-work. That's from Senator Marco Rubio. He didn't send it to Connections. That was on Twitter. But Pete, when he says being pro-family means being pro-work and this is just welfare, what comes to mind first for you?
Well, so I think it's important to grapple with that argument and to try to break down what he's actually saying there, which I think has long roots in American policy around how we help people who are struggling with low incomes and everything else. And the American kind of traditional system since at least the 90s, and you could say, predating that, is to tie receipt of any kind of benefit, to workforce participation. and to say that if you're going to qualify for whether it's SNAP or TANF assistance or, you know, even the earned income tax credit, there's a presumption that you are, you know, working outside the home and drawing a wage around that. And so we've oriented a lot of our sort of anti-poverty programs around that. And that's what he's saying. We need to stick with that. That's important. It's kind of the American way to do it. And that's the pro-family way. The problem is that the more and more you look at the evidence of that, it's not really borne out by sort of what other countries have been doing, what we've seen in America in various studies, and it has enormous consequences for really harming a lot of low-income families, particularly people who are in deep poverty and children who are living in deep poverty. If there are lots of barriers to their parents participating, you know, fully in the workforce, or they come and go in the workforce because of various issues that family may be encountering, or because you have, you know, a worldwide pandemic or a great recession or other things that harm people's workforce participation, the people who are harmed most by a lot of those work requirements end up being, you know, children who then don't have, you know, enough nutrition. They don't have, you know, the housing stability that they need to thrive. They don't have all sorts of things that children need in order to grow up and lead productive lives as adults. And so there's this long history of belief around how we have to tie all these things to work, but the evidence isn't really there. The evidence isn't there from other countries, and there's just enormous consequences that are felt by those children as children and then later in life as adults. And so I think it's time we move away from that insistence that everything be pegged to work and think of a more comprehensive way to do that. And I have lots of other thoughts on that too, but I think that's kind of the core thinking that I'm glad that a lot of people on both sides of the aisle are starting to see. And finally, just one other thing. I think there's an assumption in there that just because someone isn't working 40 hours a week in a job doesn't mean that they're not working, and that raising children is very taxing. It is absolutely work, and we should be thinking about how we appreciate care work in this in our society, and whether that's in a you know, two-parent household, in a single-parent household with other folks helping. You know, it's not always in the best interest of a child for their parent to be out, you know, working for a wage for 50, 60 hours a week. It's important for you know, parents to spend time with their children too. And a modest allowance, like what Senator Romney's proposed, what President Biden's proposed, starts to change some of that calculus for families.
Let me bring in our other guests on this. Jessica Fleming, when we talked back in October, one of the things that you made clear was whatever government seeks to do for families, it needs to be direct. The simpler, the better, as opposed to big hoops to jump through. So how do you see some of these proposals? What do you see here, Jessica?
Well, you know, like, you know, piggybacking on what Pete said, the first thing I noticed is just, you know, when you give just a set amount of cash per child because that money is needed, I appreciate and respect the thought process behind that. We can trust people to decide how their cash needs to be spent, just like people who have money, right? Poor people spend their money in similar ways to the way people who have money spend money. They spend a little bit amount of it on entertainment, on clothing, on, you know, food, shelter, all of this, right? So, you know, that's great. But then the very next thing I notice is that, you know, from a working parent's perspective, the difference of $100 for a child that's in school versus a child that's not school a month is, I mean, it just, you know, we still need to expand childcare. You know, this isn't it's not a living wage. This isn't, you know, in a universal basic income. This isn't a lot of money. You know, I think anybody who has children knows that $350 a month isn't going to cover childcare. It doesn't make up for the fact that we don't make enough. There are a lot of people who don't make enough of a wage to pay childcare. And, you know, speaking to Rubio's comment, it's interesting. One of the biggest problems that we have with our current welfare system and even things like childcare credits or housing credits is that it actually keeps a lot of people in poverty by not allowing them to increase their wage. like, you can't, if you're getting $600 a week in child care credits and you get a dollar raise and you lose $600 a week in child care, arguably our current system, if any system, is anti-work, because it forces people to kind of manage, you know, like the assistance that they're getting in all these different pockets with things like food stamps and, you know, help with electricity and help with food, you know, childcare, all of those things. You have to stay within the budget of those allowable expenses, and you could end up losing all of that help while only making an extra $40 a week, you know. So, I mean, I know from the perspective of deep poverty and for people who are living just on safety nets who don't have income, that this would be a major relief, but I also think it could end up hurting working families if it replaces some of the programs that are already in place.
Yeah, and we'll get into that in just a moment here. I mean, to Jessica's point, some of what the Romney plan would do would be to put one in place of the other. We'll talk about that coming up here.
Right.
Deandra Dukes, how do you see some of these proposals and the urgency? We invited Deandra. She was the co-author of an op-ed in the Democrat and Chronicle urging not only passage of at least the Biden plan, but a strengthening of it. How do you see some of these issues, Deandra?
Actually, I would have to agree with both. I do feel like it is a great step. But it, like as she said, you know, in regards to changing some of the systems, like, yes, it could definitely help in certain areas, but also some of the systems will have to change as well, because it's actually being a disadvantage at the same time as an advantage. So because we have a lot of people who are, you know, behind in bills and everything, and that could also affect the child in itself. So if we did have those extra finances, yes, it could help tie up loose ends, but also do other things that we could basically give the children a better life. But then also, too, if there's a lot of working poor, so say if I'm working hard, but I do receive some assistance, even if it's minimal, I'm at risk of losing that assistance now, because not only am I getting extra funds, and if you get like an extra dollar, like if you get a dollar raise per pay period or something like that, even that can affect the assistance that you receive. So just as she stated before, as long as if we can definitely give the extra funds, which would help greatly, but also change somebody's systems as well.
All right. So let's look at some of the specifics, and we'll get a little wonky here. And as a director of policy for the Children's Agenda, Pete Nabosny, that subject that that really all of our guests have been talking about, direct help and simplicity. Simplicity is something you've been talking about for years. I know I reference writers like Chris Arnotti a lot, but the part of the reason is they spend a lot of time with people who are struggling with poverty, and that the refrain they often hear is simplify, simplify, simplify. Do these plans do that for you, Pete?
So Senator Romney's plan takes a bunch of existing spending, whether it's through the tax code, which a lot of people have a hard time accessing, you know, a lot of low-income people, people who are in deep poverty, don't file taxes every year, as just a phenomenon, I guess, that because they wouldn't necessarily owe any money, they don't, you know, get in trouble for it the way that upper-income people would. But then they also don't benefit from some of these programs like the Earned Income Tax Credit, like the Child Independent Care Credit, and the Head of Household Credit, a bunch of the things that Romney proposes getting rid of. This would simplify a lot of the tax code for people and ensure that they understand what the benefit is, right? And I think in particular his proposal to have it administered through the Social Security Administration is really smart. People know what Social Security is. It's something that we all, you know, you're born in this country, you get a number at birth, you contribute to it your whole life. There's Social Security offices all around the country that can help people troubleshoot. And there's, you know, really not a stigma attached to that in a lot of ways. And it's sort of a universal benefit program that has a lot of draw. He's saying stop spending on all these other areas through the tax code, and let's have Social Security Administration administer it too. I think that the chief problem that I have with his proposal that a lot of other people have is he also proposes getting rid of TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, which is by no means a perfect program. It's really flawed. It's got a lot of problems dating back to the passage of welfare reform in the 90s, but it does help a lot of people. There's a lot of very low-income families that benefit from getting public assistance for a stretch of time. To build on Jessica's point, a lot of our child care subsidies in New York State are funded through TANF dollars. So if you get rid of TANF entirely, you know, there are people who are benefiting from that right now that would see a loss of benefit. But to kind of bring it back to simplicity piece, you have to kind of take all this stuff into consideration together and say, if everyone understands that there's this benefit that exists out there and you go and you fill out some paperwork and if there's changes in your household status, you revise that, but you know what your benefit's supposed to look like, will we see more families participating in that program, particularly families that are needier, as opposed to are we able to find the right navigation through all these systems to help certain people, you know, get the maximal benefits that they have, and then other folks, for whatever reasons and circumstances in their life, you know, aren't getting those forms of assistance. And so I think that's some of the trade-offs that we're talking about here. The Biden plan is a bit different because it doesn't try to consolidate all of these existing programs. It really layers on top of our existing, you know, patchwork of supports, this new credit that would hopefully be, you know, eventually permanent and paid out monthly through the IRS instead of Social Security. But
can I read a little bit about that, Pete? Because
sure.
Because what I think,
sure.
and I want to make sure I'm getting this right here. Part of the difference between the Biden and Romney plans is the benefits for per child under Biden are a little bit less than Romney. So it would offer $3,000 a year, $250 a month. This is the Biden plan. For parents of kids age 6 to 16, 17, not eligible. 6 to 16 instead of 6 to 17 under Romney. And then instead of $350 a month for kids up to age 6, it's $300 a month. And my understanding, Pete, is it's a one-year-only thing, though you're hoping that would become permanent. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it all gets into kind of complicated D.C. Maneuvering, but I think what they're planning to do is include this new child tax credit benefit, again, hopefully paid out monthly, although some of the details on that are a little shaky still at this point, in this year's package, and then make it sort of permanent next year. And they have to do that because of various budget reconciliation rules and 10-year funding windows and a whole bunch of other things that we could really get into the weeds on. But I think that's their stated hope. But you don't know, you don't know what's going to happen. With, you know, Congress in the future and things like that. And for families, it's also, I think, one of the key draws of a universal child benefit is the certainty of it, right? So you'll know you have this child, you're going to have this child for a while. This benefit will hopefully be something that you receive, you know, for a number of years and then helps you with sort of long-term planning. Knowing that you'll get a monthly child allowance of sorts for at least this year is good. It's just we need to make sure that it becomes permanent, and that's when you'll really start to see the long-term impact of the positive results associated with lowering poverty, of better school performance, and kids doing better, and more housing stability, and all sorts of other things that you see as poverty is lessened. You see a lot of other general child well-being improve.
So in a moment here, I want to dig into some confusion listeners, I think, are expressing about how the current child tax credit works. Before we do that, let me just ask Jessica and Deandra to kind of follow up. And Jessica, to Pete's point about a reliability of any benefit, you know, you have a child and you know that you can rely on X amount per month or per year, you know that there are certain benefits that will be there, and they will be accessible. You won't have to go through a maze of paperwork, and they're relatively simple. Can you just give me your perspective as a mother of two about how important it is to have reliable year after year benefits that are simple?
Yeah, absolutely. Pete kind of touched on this, and I just wanted to elaborate something culturally too. In addition to all the hoops we normally jump, one thing that really, like the benefit of just this universal amount of money that's assigned to pretty much everyone except for the ultra rich is that, you know, nobody really, none of working poor people don't want to see themselves as poor. So a lot of times, like, I think a lot of people are missing benefits that they don't realize that they could get, or because what happens is that, you know, you are struggling, you're failing to be able to pay your bills, but, like, you know you make in your mind anyway a living wage, so you just kind of feel like you have to figure it out, you have to work it out. And, you know, this is the capitalist culture. Nobody wants to think of themselves as being poor. It, you know, I have friends who are surprised that I'm willing to get on the radio and describe myself as working poor, right? So already, when we are just giving everybody the money, it's taking away how many people might not get assistance just by not knowing that they qualify, or from being too proud to really go after what they need, right? And then, you know, yes, the simplicity aspect, not having to jump the hoops, not having to, you know, like, I don't know if anyone has ever applied for DSS, and outside of, I think, the way that food stamps has kind of been fixed so that you can kind of apply quickly and online, you know, it is really difficult to apply for any sort of help, and then you have to follow up every 6 months, and it's easy to fall behind for all these things. So, you know, the easier we make it, the more people are going to utilize it, and the better the system works at solving the problem it intends to solve.
Yeah, and so let me just ask you then, Jessica, I mean, you know, I have an email from a listener who just sent me a note saying, I don't want Bill Gates' kids to get a benefit of $300 a month. Does that stuff enter your mind? Do you care about, you know, sort of income limits, upper income limits, you know, thresholds, et cetera? Does that matter to you?
You know, for the listener, if I were you, I'd be much more concerned about the lack of tax that Bill Gates is paying, because it's a lot more than the $300 a month that the Bill Gates of the world might be getting for their children, unless they have 30 children. So, like, to me, that's the biggest thing. Already, we are being robbed. Like, the lower middle class, the middle class, even the upper middle class in this country, people in poverty are being robbed by the old uber rich, right? If for some reason we manage to not write them out of this and they get an extra $300 a month per child, I really don't think that that is going to break our economy. I really just don't.
Hmm. Though I think, briefly, Pete Nabosny, I think there is an upper limit on at least one of the plans. I don't have all of that in front of me. Do you know, Pete?
Yeah, they're a little bit different. There are upper limits on both Biden and Romney's plans. Romney's is higher than Biden's. I think it's $204,000 annually, and Biden's is a bit lower. I'm blanking on the exact amount right now, but that's 200 for single parents and 400 for married couples, I should say. But and the way that the Romney plan, they just say, well, we're going to recoup all that money at tax time. So if you make above that amount, like, and you received, you know, you have the one child, the $3,000 benefit will just tax you $3,000 at tax time. So you get the benefit, but then you pay it back at tax time. And upper income households don't, you know, they don't have that much trouble paying those kinds of taxes. So it takes care of that. The Biden plan is a little trickier because it relies on your prior year's earnings and sort of, you know, creates estimates based on that as it's sort of phasing out. So I'm a little concerned about how that would actually play out for a lot of middle class families. But I think the important thing, just to build on Jessica's point, is these measures to try to exclude upper income families by requiring proof of income and other, you know, means to means test something. They end up, yes, excluding upper income families who don't really need it anyway, but they end up excluding a lot of lower income families who become overburdened by the complicated paperwork that's required to prove that you deserve the money and that you don't, you know, make too much and all that. And so that's the actual trade-off we have to think about here. We don't do this kind of means testing for K-12 education. We don't say that, you know, that if you make above a certain amount of money, your kid doesn't get to go to the public school, or you have to pay tuition in addition to the public school at this graduated rate. We say that you're eligible to go to the public school, you know, and you're going to pay more in property taxes and state income taxes and things like that to help fund the school. And that's just a better universal way to bring everyone into a program and allow every child to, you know, to receive, you know, a public education. I think we could take that same kind of logic and apply it to this kind of benefit program.
Okay. Deandra Dukes, you know, as someone who works with the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, you know, I remember, what, back 5-6 years ago when RMAPI was getting off the ground, Deandra, and there was so much talk about all the different silos that all of these different agencies were sort of separated from one another and trying to offer benefits to people who self-identify as working poor and people who are struggling at the poverty line and people who didn't know the benefits were available, or to Jessica's point, you know, are probably thinking, you know, I'm working, I'm not poor, I don't need to go sign up for something. And all of this disconnect that was out there. Are you starting to see 5-6 years into RMAPI, Deandra, is there a cohesion to at least lining up help for people who truly assistance, benefits, and simplifying in ways that you think will make it more in reach for folks?
Yes, most definitely. Even as to last year when we met physically, and can't do so now due to COVID, but we would come together at these tables where we would have like everyone from social service who likes to be a part of our MAPI's mission actually say, like, how can we not only supply help to those who are in need, but also keep communication with one another. So I know that if I don't have something that I cannot offer to them, that I will send them to you. So it's been a lot more of people working together to combat this one particular issue. So I am grateful that they are seeing that, okay, well, I'm not going to just compete against this particular organization because they have such a successful turnaround, but now let's work together where we can really come and help the people that we're really trying to serve.
Let me also quote from your op-ed that you joined a couple of colleagues writing for the Democrat and Chronicle recently on this issue. You wrote, quote, "The Biden plan doesn't go far enough. It fails to disperse payments monthly, advance it to expectant mothers 4 months before delivery, and most importantly, make refundability permanent after the pandemic subsides. But once established, if established, we can build on it to ensure families get the support they need to thrive. We call on Senator Schumer to make this tax credit expansion an absolute bottom line in any negotiations over the bill," end quote. Two quick points on that. So, Deandra, thinking about expectant mothers 4 months before delivery, how important do you think it is that whatever help gets extended does include that group, that cohort of expectant moms who are often, you know, you get hit with parenthood, and that is its own thing. But all of the bills, all of the challenge, sometimes the challenge of keeping work or finding income, how important are those 4 months, and how solid do you think that help would go towards expectant mothers?
I think it's very important because I see in the community where a lot of mothers actually work up until the day prior to their delivery date, which makes no sense at all, but they have to provide for their family and the one that's on the way. So I think it will greatly assist those, especially 4 months prior, so that way the mom can really focus on not only her health, but the baby health as well.
And when it comes to that last line, calling on Senator Schumer to make at least the tax credit expansion an absolute bottom line in any negotiations over the bill, are you watching what's happening in Washington and thinking, you know what, all of these first proposals, whether it's Romney's proposal, whether it's President Biden's, they may look good in their first iteration. They're just going to whittle down everything that's good about them until we get a compromise bill that doesn't really help anybody. I don't mean to be cynical, but sometimes that is the view. What are your expectations for what happens next, Deandra?
I just really hope that they take the people in mind and actually get real life stories of those who deal with these situations, because a lot of times a lot of decisions are made based off of what we may think, which is an assumption, and that's very incorrect to do. So I really hope that these politicians just really get to sit with actual people to know what's going on and how what they're trying to propose can actually help or not at all.
Melissa in Penfield, Andrew in Rochester, hang there. If you've emailed or called, please stay right there. We're going to come right back. We'll take Melissa's call after this only break, and we're going to continue with the conversation about the various proposals that are out there that would really change things. I mean, I don't mean to sort of be overly reductive or flip about it, but you've got multiple organizations saying if any of these proposals pass, whether it's Senator Romney's or President Biden's, there could be a dramatic reduction in child poverty reasonably quickly, that you could have really quick access to change through these various bills. So we're talking about how they would work, how they would benefit kids and families, how much and who would be eligible, et cetera. With Deandra Dukes, a small business owner, a community advocate, and a cohort member of our MAPI, the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Jessica Fleming, a single mother of two. Pete Nabosny, director of policy for the Children's Agenda. And we're back to your phone calls and emails next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, a local organization is hosting citizen panels aimed at dismantling polarization. They say dialogues like their panels with neighbors and elected leaders can create more common ground on issues throughout the country. It's a view of reducing polarization in politics and beyond. We'll try to do that on Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Melissa in Penfield on the phone with us now. Go ahead, Melissa.
Oh, hi. I hung up on you by accidental, but there you go.
Yeah.
So I was calling to say that I had no idea for years and years that I was qualifying for this for my children, the EIC. And then I found out from my employer, and I still didn't know what to do with it because it was so complicated for me. So now then I married someone who's more savvy with that kind of stuff. And so we got it finally. But I mean, I probably missed out 10, 15 years of, you know, payments. But anyway, so that was one thing I wanted to say. Then when somebody was talking about how we, you know, it's difficult because if you just make a little more, now you lose your whole benefit. That is something that we didn't know all about that. So 1 year, $2 more, and we lost our insurance. So now for two extra dollars, you know, over the amount. I mean, that's not even two extra dollars in the, you know, per hour. It's not that. It was just
two raw dollars. Yeah.
Yeah, I might be exaggerating. I remember it that way. Then we lost our health insurance and we lost the benefit that year. But the health insurance now we learned, gosh, if you don't go to stay in the system, then you can never go back to get this benefit. So, you know, the health insurance that we had, which is the Medicaid. So that's a real problem, this weaning. I swear, if that's all they did, it would help working people, okay? If that's all they did. And then was there one more thing? Oh, yeah. So the other thing is we have an adult dependent right now, hopefully not, you know, forever, but a 23-year-old. And they're more expensive than when I was raising them earlier. So that's all I'm saying. She said something about experience, like to hear from people's experience. Those are my little takes.
Well, Melissa, do you think policymakers, whatever level of government they are, but especially in Washington, do you think they get what you're going through?
I have no idea. But if they did, I guess maybe not, because, you know, if they did, I think that somebody would attack this whole weaning off problem. Somebody would do that at least. And also, just to get the word out there, I mean, I've got my master's. You know, I did not know about this. How did I miss this, you know, for so many years, you know? And you don't get retroactive anything, of course. So, and I've just been very lucky because my home, I inherited my home. And my home is very small and the taxes are not much so far. But those things I was able to handle. And then I kind of wonder about the people that make $200,000. Are you kidding me? But then I think, yeah, but they have bills too, probably huge bills. You know, house, big mortgage, car payments. But, you know, we can't even afford an extra car so that my adult dependent can have time to, it's like, it's very complicated. You know, we cannot, we have an old junker and my husband needs it to get to work. So, and we're older, you know, we're like 62. So anyway,
well, Melissa, I'm grateful for your experience and thank you for being willing to share it with us.
Okay. Maybe they could comment on, anything that came to mind.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I appreciate that, Melissa. I'm going to start with Jessica Fleming because some of what Melissa's talking about, and I'm sure Pete and Deandra have something to say about the cliff too, but I mean, Jessica, this idea that you could be on the verge of actually losing benefits without knowing it. You know, to Melissa's recollection, Jessica, it was two raw dollars, and all of a sudden, all those additional help supportive benefits were lost. But, I mean, I know you talked a little bit about that. You want to respond to some of what you heard?
Yeah, and I mean, what she spoke on about with the earned income credit, right? Same thing with us. I don't know how many times I missed that. I have two kids. I don't know how many times I missed that before someone told me about it, because I don't know when it started. And I'm someone who pays attention to policy, right? So it does make me wonder how many people who have two kids aren't getting that. Which, yeah, so that all goes back to the simplicity issue, Melissa. And then also, you know, like not having to figure out how many hours you worked and not pick up overtime so that you don't lose your benefits, like, and not having to feel like bad about applying for help because, you know, the Mark Rubios of the world are yelling from the rooftop that people who need help are bad people who are lazy, you know? So, all of it and all back down to the fact that raising children is work and the idea that anyone would have a child just for $350 a month doesn't spend enough time with children. So, yes, a lot of what Melissa said resonated with me.
And I just want to say, Jessica, MJ from Buffalo sends us a note online saying, regarding Jessica's point regarding the caps Bill Gates pays, spot on, girlfriend. That's from MJ in Buffalo. So I think just some supportive feedback on some of what we're hearing. But Pete Nabosny, I keep thinking of, I think the phrase you used last week on this program, talking about state benefits, not federal, was a cliff for families. And that's what we're hearing with Melissa, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it's a real challenge that our existing, public assistance array of benefits sort of embraces in a lot of ways. And again, I think it comes from this, we have this belief in our policymaking, you know, that it is enshrined in law. I'm not saying everyone agrees with it, but the way that it's currently structured is that if you're not working, then you're not as deserving of benefits. And so we have this concept of deserving poor, or if you're not working enough, you're not deserving. Right? So that's on the one end. So we have these phase-ins, and we exclude a lot of very low-income families from certain benefit programs. And then we have an expectation, well, once you get to a certain point, then we can't help you anymore, and we're cutting you off. And the problem is that that's not really responsive to when families may no longer need some level of support. It's arbitrary, and it's arbitrary across these different program types. So you have different phase outs or cliffs for child care assistance, for food stamps or SNAP, for Medicaid, for heating assistance, for a range of things. And then you have those things that phase out, like the earned income tax credit. So these things are all in a mix. And when people start to actually look at their personal situation, everyone has different points at which, you know, an additional bit of earnings puts them over on one side of the ledger rather than the other, and then they lose a certain benefit. And whether that's, you know, all the things I said or Section 8, you know, there's just a lot of things in there. And that complexity can be extremely difficult for people to navigate, and it sets up a lot of very difficult choices for families as they try to make the best decision for their own, you know, economic security of, do you take on those additional hours or do you decline them because you're worried about the loss of a benefit? And you may not have perfect information at that point to know exactly when you're going to be losing that benefit or how it's going to be calculated and what your child care copay is going to get adjusted to and so on and so forth. So this doesn't solve all that. I don't want to, you know, oversell it. Neither of these proposals addresses all those issues. But what it does say on a particular form of sort of income support for you for raising children is that we are going to set the line at which it starts to phase out way beyond any of these other programs. You know, when we talk about, Medicaid or SNAP or child care subsidies, things like that, it's, you know, somewhere depending on the program between 1% and 200% of the poverty threshold. So for a family of four, $25,000 to $50,000 a year. When you talk about, Senator Romney's proposal, you're talking about $200,000 to $400,000 a year is when I phase out. So it's a whole order of magnitude away from where a lot of these phase outs that currently harm people are. And that, again, doesn't address all these problems, but it begins to say, you'll have that child allowance through all those other phase outs. So you don't have to worry about losing that benefit if your taxable income goes up $5,000 this year or down $10,000 and up $15,000, you know, all those kinds of things. You can count on this benefit for a long time until you get to an income situation, which, you know, God bless you, you're well beyond, the point at which these other benefits have phased out. And I think that's we have to address these other problems with our existing array of benefits, but that's a real merit to both President Biden and Senator Romney's proposals is to provide that support way up the income ladder. And that makes it more popular as well for more middle-class families.
Yeah, Melissa in Penfield, thank you. Deandra Dukes, anything you want to add to her phone call?
Yes. I'm in agreement with all of you because literally, I mean, it helps a little bit, but then it, like just what Pete was saying, it makes you have to wonder, okay, well, do I take that extra time because I might lose the extra benefit that is actually helping, despite that I might, you know, be in a position where I'm still lacking, but at least that helps. So that's all I just want to add on that part.
Okay. On the subject of the current child tax credit, Andrew writes to say, why should someone get a tax credit if they don't work and they don't pay taxes in the first place? That is essentially Senator Rubio's argument. And how the current child tax credit works, my understanding is the credit offers parents up to $2,000 a year, but the benefits are limited when it comes to families who are dealing with poverty. And let me just read from Vox's explanation. They write, quote, that's because households have to earn at least $2,500 per year for the credit to be refundable, or for households that don't have a tax liability to actually receive the benefit. And only $1,400 at most is refundable. Poor families that don't make $2,500 a year can never get the full $2,000. An American without any taxable income, for example, a single mom with a child who lives with family but doesn't have a job because of the recession or some other barrier, won't owe any taxes. But because her income falls below $2,500 a year threshold, there's no benefit from the current child tax credit. And Andrew seems to be saying good, whereas the Romney plan and the Biden plan say no. We want credits for children, regardless of work. Is that right, Pete? Regardless of work situation, this would change that. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's the fundamental. So yes, this would change that. This would say that they're not going to look at how low your income is or your absence of income as a determinant of whether or not you receive support for your family. The only time they'll look at it is when you're way up the income spectrum either. It gets taxed back that way. So yeah, this fundamentally changes that sort of presumption of how this kind of thing is structured.
All right. So let me just ask all three of you then to I know we've kind of gone around on this a little bit, but Andrew's email says, why should someone get a tax credit if they're not working, not earning money, not paying taxes? Senator Rubio saying the same as our emailer. So let's hit this one more time, Pete. You know, so this would fundamentally change how that works if one of these proposals goes through here. What's the short answer to Andrew, Pete?
Well, yeah. So I guess the short answer is, I mean, what are we trying to achieve with a policy of a child tax credit, right? Are we just trying to offset some of the cost of taxes paid by people, or are we trying to ensure that the children grow up surrounded by some amount of economic security and support, so that they have the ability to, thrive. And that's what I would say. You know, I think we see enormous challenges, in our community with high rates of child poverty, with all sorts of associated ills that kind of draw from that. And saying we're willing to give some amount of money to families, regardless of their income, even families who have very low income because of circumstances that Andrew and I probably don't understand fully, that has enormous benefits for the children who are growing up in that household. And to me, that's worth it. That's worth saying. As a society, we want to ensure that every child grows up with some level of support, and that Ultimately, in the end, that benefits all of society because that child grows up more productive and healthier and has done better in school, you know, on average, and all sorts of other associated benefits. And it saves us a lot of money in the long run. So I believe it is like a kind of a moral issue that we have some obligation to support one another's children, and that that should be an important sort of community standard that we set. But even if you don't share that sort of particular communitarian belief, you know, and you really just want to look at the dollars and cents of this thing, Columbia University Center on Poverty and something or another put out the other day that, you know, an analysis they had of the impact of the Biden proposal. And, you know, it's like an 8-to-1 cost benefit analysis of you get $8 back in societal benefits of lower spending and all sorts of other types of programs for every $1 you spend on this kind of child tax benefit. So if that's what appeals to you, you know, then you should look that way, because we're costing ourselves a lot as a society by, you know, frankly neglecting, you know, children who come from really low income backgrounds through that sense of that family doesn't deserve some level of basic assistance.
All right. DeAndre, you want to respond to Andrew, who's wondering why someone should get a tax credit if they're not working and not paying taxes.
Yes. The reason why everyone should get it, I mean, realistically, do we want everyone to be in poverty? Because if everyone can pull themselves out of poverty and actually be able to be a help in the community with taxes or just finances in general, I would think that would be the ultimate goal. We would definitely want people to become better. So despite their situation, if they have a job or not, I'm pretty sure that they want the best for their child. So I think that we all should not just look at it from a personal standpoint, but just looking at it from a generalization.
Annie writes to say, I have an answer for Andrew. I have 2 master's degrees. I am paying off those loans. I don't make enough money to pay for childcare, so I am not working. So she's in a situation where certainly needs that benefit and finds that to be a perfectly appropriate way to use it. What do you say, Jessica Fleming, to Andrew's email?
You know, I'm going to step away from continuing this idea that people who went to school and who have money and make money are more deserving of children and children that are surviving than people who don't make money. I have to move away from that idea. I can't agree about that. But even if you do, if you believe that kids whose parents are poor deserve to be poor, then, you know, what that $8 to $1 looks like on a more practical level, because I needed to kind of see that, is that, you know, when you collectively look at what happens to people in poverty, children who are raised poor, whether that be the justice system and, you know, like for not getting proper medical care, so the expense of the Medicaid further down the line, the expense of homelessness, the expense of all of the things that we have to end up having to fight, because poverty is the root of pretty much all of our social problems, right? That's what that $8 to $1 looks like. So if you don't care about anyone else in the world, which since this pandemic has started, I know is a lot of Americans, you don't care about other Americans, it's just costing you more money to have more kids in poverty. That's why.
Wow. The lines are scorching today, but I mean, I take the point, Jessica. And as we get ready to wrap here, let me ask you all just maybe about 45 seconds apiece just for some final thoughts as we look ahead here. Pete, I mean, we kind of focused on Romney and Biden's plans and some limited set of proposals. What else do you want people thinking about as we look at what Washington will or won't do here?
Sure. So I think it's key. I mean, this is from the children's agenda's perspective, trying to find any way that we can contribute to the conversation to ensure that some version of a child allowance, a fully refundable credit, is included in the next batch of COVID relief and long-term budget planning is like our number one priority. But we can't forget about some of these other programs we've been talking about. You know, SNAP needs additional funding. Unemployment insurance, which we've spoken about in the past, expires in mid-March, which is coming up real soon, and hopefully will be extended until at least August or September. So there's a lot there. There's still a lot of support that families need. This has been a really tough year. We're approaching about a year of life in COVID now. We desperately need the federal government to continue to you know, spend money where it has been and expand some of the areas where it hasn't, state and local aid, all those kinds of things. But I, you know, particularly in the children's agenda, we really want to see some version of this child allowance pass, because it really would be transformational for addressing child poverty in the United States and in our community here, which is, as we know, has one of the highest rates in the developed world. So we've got a lot of work to do, and this would really help make a great down payment on that.
All right, DeAndre Dukes, final thoughts from you.
Yes, I just really urge, you know, all politicians to really just look beyond themselves, as I stated before, really get in the community and find out what things that could really benefit the community, but also, as we all should be, just as a human duty, to just look beyond ourselves and think about others. So I really feel that if we can get some laws changed as well, in addition to getting these finances, I believe it could help the not just, you know, Rochester, New York, but the nation, you know, mm-hmm. United States of America, period.
And Jessica Fleming, final thoughts from you.
I guess just that I like this idea to keep moving forward towards a more universal basic income approach. So all of, you know, I know that this, any bill that comes is going to get, you know, diced up, as you pointed out. But what I'd like is the idea of keep moving towards this idea of just simplifying, give everybody the benefit, you know, this way, when you get promoted, you aren't losing money for getting a promotion. This way people don't have to deal with the, you know, we've already even heard it in the comments, the you know, the cultural aspects of mm-hmm. poverty and even being working poor. Any universal basic income, it's happening all over the world, so it's, you know, time to get on board.
Thanks to all of you for fitting us in. Jessica Fleming, thanks for making time for us again.
Thanks for having me.
DeAndre Dukes, nice having you back here, and I know we'll talk to you again about your work with RMAPI, the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Thank you, DeAndre.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great one.
And Pete Nabosny, Director of Policy for the Children's Agenda. Thank you, sir.
Thanks. Fun as always.
Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We're back with you tomorrow on Member-Supported Public Radio.